Train yourself to allow for their pauses, and false starts as they work to articulate their thoughts. Be aware that there might not be a recognizable point. They may simply be offering you a tasty bit of information. If you're asking them to repeat what you've just told them, allow them enough time to do it, even if they have to stop and struggle to remember. Go gently. Body language. Face your son when talking to him. Sit on the floor if that's where he's playing. Although he is not as adept as a girl would be at reading expressions, he needs to see your face because it helps focus his attention. Don't get angry with him if he ignores a stern glance or a tiny head shake of disapproval. He probably didn't register it. Keep your shoulders down and your arms relaxed. No waving your hands or pointing and jabbing in the air. The workarounds. You can't force a boy to care about hanging up his wet towel, empathize when a friend trips and falls, or want to sit quietly when his biology is screaming at him to leap up and race across an open field. But there are ways to help your son adjust his behavior so he isn't always on the receiving end of other people's wrath and disappointment. What not to say? Your behavior is inappropriate. You need to focus in class and stop being so disruptive. Then you'll have more success. Abstract words like inappropriate, focus, disruptive, and success mean little to a small boy. When delivered in a stern, preachy tone, they sound like the wah, 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 wah of the adults in the Peanuts cartoons. Rather than hoping your logic will convince your son to change, approach him as a co-conspirator. Act as if you are a cultural anthropologist, familiarizing him with the odd but predictable ways of members of different tribes. Your tone should be collegial as you confide. Listen, Jesse, all the people you're having trouble with, girls, your grandparents, the older boys at school, teachers, even your mom and me, we all have similar reactions to certain things you and all kids do. It may not make much sense, but the secret to getting into less trouble is to learn the patterns. It's like a code. If you can memorize how these people will react, you'll be able to predict what will make them mad or disappointed. You won't have to wonder, what did I do this time? The mischief and mouthing off that adults find so irritating are normal expressions of boys' verve, swagger, and desire to entertain or provoke in what they see as a fair and playful fashion. I'm going to list the most common of these behaviors, along with an example of how you might present them to your son. As you listen, you may find yourself thinking, my son is very bright. Surely he knows this already. He's just choosing not to act civilized. But certain social norms can strike boys as ridiculous or baffling, which is why it's helpful to spell things out. Then it's his choice. Maybe pulling his sister's hair and hearing her shriek is worth the time out. Maybe not. Don't get into an argument about whether this is right or wrong or she's being a wimp. And don't soft-pedal information with qualifiers like, I know you like to make the kids in class laugh and you're so funny, but you have to pay attention, okay? Instead, you are delivering vital secret codes, and you need to be straightforward. Rather than loading your son up with a pre-programmed rule book, wait until some choice he's made has led to a bit of trouble. Boys are rarely remorseful about their transgressions because they don't think they've done anything wrong. Instead, he'll likely be indignant or puzzled. Treat this reaction not as stupidity or willful rudeness, but as simple ignorance. Then step in with the secret knowledge, using the same matter-of-fact tone you did when he was a toddler and you taught him not to pull the puppy's ears. With your guidance, he'll be able to start practicing self-control. In these examples, I use terms such as get mad at you and yell at you, because your son will instantly understand what you mean. Children typically use the phrase yelled at me to describe any type of reprimand, even the mildest. Teasing others about their appearance. If you make fun of the way someone looks or the clothes they're wearing, even if they know you like them, sometimes they may insult you back. Sometimes they may feel embarrassed or get mad at you. It may hurt their feelings. This is usually more true for girls and adults, but lots of boys are sensitive too. If your son is getting into trouble for teasing or insulting other kids, you can also say some version of, if you insult someone's appearance and they tell their parent or the teacher, a grown-up may lecture you, punish you, or call me. Some kids don't mind being teased. Others mind it a lot. Pay attention and see how different people react. Teasing others about their performance. The rules for teasing about appearance also apply to performance with an extra caveat. Today's parents are particularly thin-skinned about doubts cast on their child's abilities, even by another child. So try to raise your son's consciousness about offering what he sees as constructive criticism along the lines of, "Your pitching sucks." He may shrug and say, "Just telling the truth, Mom, and everybody knows it." Maybe so, but learning how to give subtle yet useful critiques and knowing when to keep quiet is a social skill best acquired early. Try telling your son, when someone makes a mistake, they usually know it and already feel bad. Before saying anything, wait to see what happens. If someone else criticizes them, see how they react and how the adults react. Saying something mean may get you into trouble, even if it's true, and it may hurt the other person's feelings. Or, rather than insulting someone who messed up, think about an observation you made that might help them improve. For example, I have an idea about a different way to stand that might help your pitch. If they want to know what it is, they'll ask you. Blurting out a negative opinion. When a thought pops into your head, let's say you think the show your sister is watching is dumb, or the homework your teacher assigned is boring, or your friend chose the wrong brand of skateboard, stop first and think about what might happen if you tell them. The person may feel annoyed with you, or they may not want to be your friend anymore, even if you're right or your comment made everybody laugh. Some people are more touchy than others. If you watch how they react in different situations, it's not too hard to figure out. When you're meeting someone for the first time, it's always better not to criticize them. Interrupting. If you cut people off when they're talking, they may lose their train of thought or think you don't care about what they're saying. Wait until there's a pause in their story and then respond to what they've said or jump in with a story of your own that's on the same topic. Touching, pulling, shoving. I'm sure you've already noticed that girls and boys play in different ways. Most girls will get angry, hurt, cry, or tell a grown-up if you poke, shove, hit, pull their hair, yank on their clothes, or punch them, even playfully. Your guy friends may react differently, but some boys do mind. Your best bet is to start out by being gentle and not touch people unless you're friends and you know they won't care. And never be rough with grown-ups unless they invite you to, like when you and Dad play Pirate Blackbeard or Ninja Warrior. Clowning around in class. Sometimes a teacher will laugh at your joke and sometimes she'll get mad. Usually, you'll figure out her sense of humor as you get to know her. Before you make a funny comment, consider that you might get yelled at or labeled a troublemaker. Think about your track record with that particular teacher and ask yourself if it's worth the risk. Distracting other students. It's hard for teachers to hold the attention of a class, especially if there are a lot of students and no aide or co-teacher. Distracting other kids by whispering or gesturing or passing notes makes the teacher's job harder, even if you're helping them. Teachers don't like it. Of course, when you're working in groups or teams, it's fine to talk to other students. Grossing people out. Many people have a different reaction to gross things than you and your friends do. Although you may think it's funny to gross them out, kids may call you stupid or a baby, tell other kids, or yell. An adult might punish you. Being too loud, inside and outside voices. Tell the boy, "Let me show you what adults consider to be an inside voice compared to an outside voice." Starting with the softest possible whisper, say, "I love big red balloons." Okay, now a little louder. Continue until you hit the outside voice level and call that level 7. Then go past it until you're both screaming and laughing. Label that level 10. Then say, "Inside, you always want to aim for 4 or 5. That goes for when you're inside a car, too, because any extra big noise can distract the person who's driving. Outside, if you talk louder than a level 7, even if you're in our backyard or on the playground, if there are adults nearby, someone's going to tell you to be quiet, or a stranger might worry that you're having a problem. Acting on impulse. Teaching boys how to recognize and name big feelings. Boys take longer than girls to recognize the thoughts and physical signs that mean a big, uncomfortable feeling is happening right now. Let's see which one and what might have caused it and what I can do to make myself feel better without getting into trouble. A boy hears mom rebuking him for grabbing a toy from his baby sister, or the teacher calling him out for kicking the chair in front of him, or dad accusing him of lying about being pushed by another kid, and he can't explain why he did it because he honestly doesn't know. Adults can help young boys connect the dots between their impulsive actions and their feelings by introducing them to concepts expressed in words like being jealous of the baby, grab, frustrated and discouraged when the teacher explains fractions again and you still don't understand, kick, and embarrassed when you trip and tear your new jeans and get dirt and pebbles in your knee, lie. What often differentiates boys from girls, as we'll see when we discuss this topic in the next chapter, is that the girls are aware they're feeling something, they just don't have the exact word for it. They might say they hate somebody when what they actually feel is envy. Boys don't necessarily make that much of a connection. They may have no idea why they grabbed the toy or kicked the chair. They just felt like it. Listening while your son tells his side of the tale, you might have some success in guiding him to acknowledge feelings of which he was unaware, which led to reactions or choices that led to trouble. If he's open to it, you can point him to specific physical reactions that help him realize he's upset like a tummy ache, a strong reaction to a minor injury, a pounding heart, or feeling sweaty. But this method won't be effective if he's still feeling stung or resentful or humiliated. Sending him to his room to think about it can be helpful by giving you a chance to calm down. But from his perspective, what is there to think about besides the unfairness of the world or how often he has bad luck or is just plain misunderstood? Sometimes the best way to help young boys gain insight about their actions and feelings is to use an indirect approach. For boys and men, saving face is of utmost importance. So pick a feeling your son needs to understand and insert the concept into a setting that does not involve him. For example, while reading a bedtime story, gently stop the action to pose a question. Ask him what he thinks the character feels or how he would feel if he were in that situation. Then repeat what he said, agree, so true, so sad, and deepen the landscape of emotions. If that happened to me, I might feel a little excited and a little worried. This way your son doesn't have to acknowledge his own hurt, fear, or anger, but hearing a parent name it models and teaches empathy. It also reinforces the neural pathways for compassion toward himself and others. Certainly, every one of us, even after years of therapy, is still learning to recognize the relationship between triggering events or thoughts and our own feelings. Offering young boys options besides fight, flee, stew, or pretend it never happened saves them from unnecessary anguish and gives them tools they can use to reflect before reacting to the next emotional challenge. A hero needs a quest. All young boys face the same three existential questions. How can I be myself without getting into trouble? Does anyone consider me a hero? What do I contribute to this family that someone else doesn't already contribute better? The strategies we've looked at so far should help your son with the first question. As you spend less time arguing over his behavior, the nuances of his personality will come into focus, and you can steer him toward activities that will let him be a hero and nurture his unique contributions. Your son's quirks and passions will become clear bit by bit. Observe and listen. Let him talk in the dark, in the car, while moving, while waiting for the bus or sitting on the subway. In general, he's more comfortable chatting side by side than face to face. The full frontal technique is for important requests or reprimands, not casual chats. Your role is to be attentive and receptive to the commentary. Some boys prefer to write down a big thought, confession, or heartfelt sentiment and slip a note under your door rather than say it in person. If you leave little notes every so often on his desk, night table, or pillow, you've opened up an avenue of communication he hadn't realized was available, and he'll be more likely to do the same. As for your contribution to conversations with your son, shooting hoops is a good metaphor. You say a little something, and then another little something, and sometimes it goes through. You get a basket. With young boys, this approach works much better than long, serious discussions and explanations. Much will be revealed on the walk or drive to school if you stay curious, which means resisting the urge to use the time to remind or instruct. Instead, ask easygoing questions or make comments with interesting content. I noticed that the Melmans got a new dog, a really big one. Have you seen any new developments on our block lately? A dialogue can unfold. On Halloween, the people who live in the house next to the Melmans gave out super gross candy. Ooh, gross looking or gross tasting? Both! Mom, am I weird? I think I don't really like most Halloween candy. I would call that having a discerning palate. This comment uses a new term in context, great for vocabulary building. You know what you like. It's interesting because you get really excited to go trick-or-treating. 'Cause I want to get a lot of candy, the most candy, but I don't want to eat it. I want to have the candy to trade, especially when other kids run out. That makes sense. You've figured out your strategy. During a 20-minute stroll around the neighborhood, you can pursue a goal such as finding a really good stick, one that's thick and long and straight. Boys seek bounty, a rotting bird corpse, a pile of shattered car window glass, and they need a good stick to prod their discoveries. If you have alleys in your neighborhood, try wandering down them. Inspect the abandoned furniture. Peer through a hole in the fence to someone's backyard. Gaze at the contents of an open garage crammed with junk. It's like going on a treasure hunt or brazenly ignoring a no trespassing sign, which little boys and plenty of girls love to do. A physician friend of mine, always working long hours, used to take her son on fake errands up to an hour away to give them uninterrupted time alone together in the car. She had an older daughter as well, but finding time to talk with her wasn't a challenge and didn't require choreography. Now when this 24-year-old son comes home to visit, he always asks his mom if she'd like to accompany him on some errands. Sweet. Fine conversations may take place when you're ambling alongside your son, but equally fun are the tales of daring do he'll bring home from solo treks or those with friends. Find opportunities for him to play outdoors in the least restricted environment you can abide. Free time, no structure, no parents, and room to roam creates fertile soil for his budding narrative technique. Like the synchronicity between learning to eat solid food and learning to speak, boys' desire to venture into wild places supports their verbal development. Their emotional wiring makes it difficult for them to articulate feelings, but they'll be bursting to tell you about the squirrel trap they built in your backyard and to explain in detail how it works. Don't worry, it probably won't. Where can your children, both girls and boys, run around and have pretend sword fights with branches? What can they climb on, and what can they hide under? Where can they make a clubhouse and have friends over and make up their own rules? Where can they get away from you? Family camp, the dock at Grandpa's house, your backyard, exploring the perimeter of a pond at the park. These are the places your boy can practice his heroic moves and gather a trove of stories to bring home. Free time and unstructured play does much more than cultivate children's facility with language. It also has a positive effect on their mood and spirit. Peter Gray, research professor of psychology at Boston College, studies the relationship between psychopathology and a sense of agency, developmentally appropriate control over the quality and quantity of one's daily activities. He writes, "By depriving children of opportunities to play on their own, away from direct adult supervision and control, we are depriving them of opportunities to learn how to take control of their own lives. We may think we are protecting them, but in fact we are diminishing their joy, diminishing their sense of self-control, preventing them from discovering and exploring the endeavors they would most love, and increasing the odds that they will suffer from anxiety, depression, and other disorders. In other words, a hero needs, really needs, a quest, and an adult he can tell all about it. Amazing facts, world records, and other believe it or nots. The third part of a boy's predicament, what do I contribute to this family that someone else doesn't already contribute better, is a trick question, because you and your son may have different definitions of contribute. You may consider it to be performance-based and an element of family citizenship, help siblings, do chores, cooperate with parents. It's true that those are vital to your son's sense of place and purpose within your family, but they are not worth as much to an imaginative little boy as the true coin of his realm, information. The 400 kinds of sharks, the tallest building in the world, the smallest video camera used by the CIA, the most baskets ever shot in a single game. How would you know about these astounding facts if he didn't tell you? Try to be enchanted with his enchantment, even when his preferred topics fall far outside the range of subject matter you normally find compelling. How? One tactic is to act a bit ignorant, seeking his expert knowledge no matter how meager. Your enthusiasm is a deposit in the bank of goodwill. Say, interesting. What else do you know about micro-robots? Are there other tricks spies use? Of course, he may be reciting the same roster of dinosaurs you've already heard 50 times, the stale inventory that makes you want to steer your car to a liquor store. The reason he's repeating himself is that he's run out of material. Little boys need more information not only to sate their curiosity, but also to keep you captivated. The surest way to refresh the monologue is to feed him some new facts and experiences via books, videos, or outings. A trip to the library, harbor, pier, or train station. A ride up the elevator in a tall building. A morning at the flea market or farmer's market. Or a big ticket excursion to the museum, aquarium, or zoo. You can get your son to change the channel by exposing him to more channels. Boys want to prove themselves to be masters of a universe. Collecting information is a way of getting their arms all the way around a topic. If that information involves superlatives, the biggest, strongest, fastest, even better. Extremes are good. What's the fastest animal? The cheetah. How fast? 75 miles per hour. What animal kills its prey the fastest? The alligator snapping turtle. Its prey dies instantly. Some parents and sons naturally share affinities, and some get to introduce each other to novel realms. If either parent feels ignorant or unmoved by their boy's passions, they can try switching the channel to a different interest or studying up. It can be as simple as Googling a few facts and saying, "Yesterday I found out that." Listen to your son's response, and you'll learn what enthralls him. Among the topics and concepts to consider for their fascination potential, superlatives, the biggest, fastest, tallest, smallest, heaviest, longest, loudest, deepest, oldest, strongest. Superpowers. Magic. You can fool the eye and trick people. Spies. You have a different identity. You can wear a disguise. Codes. You have special secret knowledge. Detectives. Ninjas. Athletes. Astronauts. Extreme terrain. Space. Deserts. Oceans. The jungle. The distance between Mars and Jupiter. The number of Earths that would fit into the sun. The Mariana Trench and the strange creatures that dwell there. Death Valley, the lowest and hottest place on Earth. The Amazon River, longest on Earth. home to the anaconda, the longest snake. They eat goats. Giant creatures, dinosaurs, whales, giant squid, elephants, grizzly bears, woolly mammoths. Predators, kill times, methods of killing. How do they consume their prey? Deadliest Warrior. This television series aired from 2009 to 2011 and covered a topic about which boys love to speculate. Who would have won, a samurai or a Viking? A pirate or a Mongol? Watch a few episodes with your son and you'll have plenty to discuss. Monster Bug Wars. The same thing as Deadliest Warrior, but with insects. Find them on YouTube. Modes of transportation. Big, 18-wheelers, super stretch limos, the Titanic. Exotic, submarines, blimps. Future, hoverboards that really hover, driverless cars, jetpacks. Scores, game averages, player stats. For non-sporty parents, this can be a tough one, but give it a try if your son is so inclined. You may discover your inner fan. If you accept that listening and talking to a young boy is different from the familiar back and forth between adults, or between adults and girls, you can flow along with his densely packed recitation of facts, stats, and world records. His aim is not to charm or bond, but to share the mind-blowing discoveries he's made with the ones he loves the most. Respecting your son's boyishness while respecting his school. Today's boys must deal with confounding expectations. Be a combatant on the playing field, a gentleman in the lunch line, and a scholar in the classroom. The parent's challenge is to acknowledge this high-wire act without undermining the legitimacy of institutions where a boy needs to thrive, especially school. Even as our insight into the neuroscience of gender differences has grown, and as child development experts and parents are questioning the frequent prescribing of attention deficit medications to young children, the fact remains that boys must sit quietly and perform to girl standards at school, and sometimes even at summer camps that emphasize high-level skill building. What are you as a parent to do aside from homeschooling or enrolling your son in an institution with more boy-savvy teaching strategies? If one exists near your home, your son is eligible and you can afford it. If you sense that your son is frustrated and feels like he doesn't measure up and never will, a frequent concern among the families I counsel, validate his struggle and offer empathy, but beware of employing a tone or message that signals pity. Children interpret sympathy as permission to take a pass. Dad, you know it's unfair. It's not my fault I didn't remember the assignment. Resist the impulse to team up with him to fight the school. When parents challenge the teacher on every perceived injustice and middling grade, the effort backfires. Rather than empowering the child, it increases his sense of inadequacy, leading to apathy, anger, and bitterness. And blaming the school and teacher drives experienced teachers nuts. They remember how effective it was when parents and teachers were united and children understood that they couldn't play one against the other. Despite the built-in disadvantages boys today face in many schools, solidarity among adults is usually better for children. It's consistent, and the occasional lapse in fairness is excellent practice for how the world works. Parents who side with their kids against the system are setting a dangerous and unrealistic precedent by teaching them that they are above the rules. The positive way to acknowledge the school conundrum is a bit subversive. It involves regular celebration of boyishness while subtly comparing his day at school to aspects of your adult day that are difficult and dull. For instance, you could take him to the do-it-yourself car wash and say, I spent most of the afternoon in a long meeting, and this is really fun. Let's blast this sucker clean. You're showing him that you enjoy the chance to get a little wet and kind of dirty, to let off some steam and have a good time, and washing the car is a handy way to accomplish all that. What you're demonstrating is balance. The implication is, yes, parts of the workday and school day are hard and boring, but we're both good soldiers when we're on duty. And when we're off duty, we both appreciate using a giant water hose that sprays 20 feet. Washing the car together lets your boy know that you crave the physical, unstructured, non-academic side of life just as much as he does, and you consistently look for ways to enjoy that side. Very rarely, there are situations where a particular school or teacher is causing real harm to a child. That's when you get to model diplomacy and courage, requesting a change of workload or teacher. In Chapter 10, The Trustees, you'll find more information about handling situations where a teacher is clearly unfit for the job. If your efforts fail, you may need to enroll your son in a different school. But for the great majority of parents, seeing their sons through elementary school does not require battling teachers or switching institutions. It just takes patience and an awareness of how boys develop. When my father was young, his big brother would lightly slap him on his face each morning and say, "This is to remind you to listen to the teacher today." It sounds harsh, and I'm not recommending it, but it was an acknowledgement of how hard it is for boys to sit still, a rudimentary lesson in self-control, and a reminder of the importance of taking advantage of the opportunity to learn. Then again, my dad lived in Brighton Beach, where he got to jump into the ocean and swim around the rocks or sneak into the beach club to hear the bands play live music. No adult was geo-tracking his every move. Today's boys are prisoners unless their parents make sure they have an escape hatch. It's one more reason to set your son loose where the wild-ish things are. Gaming, Thief of Time and Band of Brothers. A long, long time ago, actually about 30 years, children had little homework and had a posse of neighborhood friends right outside the front door. They set their own agenda and used all five senses in the three-dimensional world. Riding bikes, climbing trees, throwing a baseball, snowball, or water balloon. Look down your block. No kid in sight. Look at your son. The one sitting safe and warm in his room. Controller in hand. He can shoot weapons, scramble through war zones, throttle the enemy and shout at the screen, satisfying some of his natural impulses. So many aspects of technology are in flux, so many questions unresolved. Are we overly concerned about gaming and social media the way parents in the 1950s were about television? Or are we dangerously oblivious, like the doctors and cigarette ads of the same era who urged people to give your throat a vacation. Smoke a fresh cigarette. Each family and every child is different. So how can we thoughtfully decide on proper rules for gaming? It isn't easy. But gaming has been studied so extensively over the past 20 years that it is a parent's duty to set some limits. The research is disturbing enough that in 2013, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, DSM-5, identified internet gaming disorder as a new condition warranting intensive investigation. The gamers play compulsively to the exclusion of other interests, and their persistent and recurrent online activity results in clinically significant impairment or distress. They experience symptoms of withdrawal when kept from gaming. The likelihood is remote that your child will become addicted to video gaming in the clinical sense of being dysfunctional in multiple areas of life. Only about 8% of gamers between the ages of 8 and 18 meet that criteria. For most boys, friendship in the digital age includes playing network games via voice, which leads to collaboration, conversation, the fun of trash talking, and feelings of happy connection. A large nationally representative study published in the journal Pediatrics showed that children aged 10 to 15 who play video games on any platform for an hour or less a day demonstrate better psychosocial adjustment compared with no play, whereas the opposite was true for those engaging in more than 3 hours of daily play. Still, for many parents and their sons, daily wrangling over the extent of time spent gaming is a source of perpetual conflict. Although the boys may not hole up in their rooms for days without eating or bathing, their hours-long gaming sessions meet the non-clinical popular definition of addiction. Randy Kuhlman, PhD, founder of Learning Works for Kids, a company that evaluates educational apps and videos, concurs. In terms of psychological adjustment, playing for 1 hour a day seems to be the healthiest amount of time. To detach your child from a game, they suggest establishing a consistent routine. Give a 10-minute warning when the session is about to end, and use a visual timer the child can see. When time's up, have a post-game tradition in place, such as eating a snack or discussing the recent session. You can introduce your child to the concept of limits by drawing a comparison to yourself. With lots of fun things, our cravings overpower judgment about what's good for us. Take chocolate cake. If I had it in the house all the time, I'd want to eat too much of it, even though I know that's not healthy. My desire would be stronger than my willpower. I can't let you play video games longer than is healthy for you, even though I understand that you disagree with me about it right now. As boys get older, most demand games that immerse them in combat, fantasy world, or criminal activities where success means chasing people, gunning them down, or otherwise vanquishing them. The most recent research findings don't show a correlation between playing violent video games and violent real-life behavior. But again, moderation and knowledge of your own child will guide you. There is one other question worth pondering. What are boys not doing when they're playing video games? They're not interacting face-to-face with other children or adults in varied environments. Boys, much more than girls, need practice with person-to-person communication, real-life impulse control, articulating thoughts and feelings, compromising, and reading people's expressions. The more socially awkward the boy, the more he'll be negatively impacted by not getting to practice these interpersonal skills. A group of gaming buddies can definitely be a positive part of a young boy's life, but limits are needed and non-gaming playdates and outings are still essential. With gaming, there's a healthy to unhealthy continuum that goes like this. Interest leads to pleasure and skill acquisition, which leads to passion and pride, which leads to preoccupation, which leads to obsession. How can you tell where your son falls? Look at the big picture of his life for guidance in setting rules about duration of play. Does he enjoy friends apart from gaming with them, for example, in sports, theater, hanging out in the neighborhood? Do his teachers describe him as a spirited person who participates in a range of activities in school? Note, I'm not asking if he is a leader or outgoing or popular. Despite American ideals, these are not qualities essential to emotional health. Does he enjoy spending time at family gatherings and on trips? Does he have a grandparent, uncle, cousin, friend of the family, or friend's parent with whom he enjoys talking and who enjoys talking to him? Does he have passionate interests, collecting baseball cards or facts or stories that provide him with special expertise and conversational fodder to use with new friends and acquaintances? If you can answer yes to most of these questions, you probably have your gaming timer calibrated just right. Keep an alert eye on the balance in his life and adjust as needed. The Bank of Goodwill for Boys. We've seen how boys love to impress their parents with their knowledge, skills, jokes, and nerve. Your enthusiasm for your son's passions and tolerance for some of the jetsam he leaves in his wake are reliable sources of funding for the Bank of Goodwill. By demonstrating not only your love but also your respect, you earn your son's trust, smoothing the way for your larger agenda. All the instruction on language, manners, behavior, and empathy that are so vital to his growth. With that in mind, here are some more suggestions for adding to the Bank of Goodwill. Sign him up for a kid's cooking class. They're full of boys. Why? Fire, chopping, grilling, knife sharpening. The junior chefs learn how to use all sorts of tools that are usually off limits and also how to prepare some meals. Let him completely take over a part of the backyard or the weedy, overgrown side yard, always a favorite boy haunt. Let him do whatever he wants in his bedroom as long as it does not include allowing food to rot, and with the caveat that he not leave his personal belongings, including shoes that could cause others to trip, drinking glasses and plates he used, in other rooms of the house. He abides by the neatness level in the rest of the house, but gets to do what he wants in his own room. If he shares a bedroom, search for a place in your home that can be his private domain and where he can be messy indefinitely, like a corner of the basement, attic, or garage. Take him to a big league athletic competition, a setting where hollering, booing, and jumping for joy is proper etiquette, or out beyond where the waves break at the beach, or on the fastest roller coaster. Let him pick a recorded book to listen to in the car. Speculate about the characters with no topic off limits. Enter the crannies of his world. Allow him to wear the same outfit to school many days in a row, even if it includes a cape and boots, as long as the items are clean, frayed or faded are fine. Let him have one free day off school each semester for an outing or adventure, unless he's missed school frequently due to illness or to dodge a test. He gets to choose the day and the agenda. This is not a reward for performance. It is a pure gift. It's a good idea for girls, too. Although young boys enter childhood with fewer words than girls, speak less, and use simpler sentences, that doesn't mean they aren't deeply and actively connected to the people around them. Parents need only attempt to speak their son's language, or in the case of fathers, remember it, and the boys will meet them halfway, absorbing a more nuanced vocabulary and, in the process, seeing their world fill in with detail and new levels of meaning. And what of their sisters? Parents won't need to speak girl to connect with them. Girls speak grown-up, beginning around age 4. But there is still much parents can teach their daughters about communicating in our complex culture, as we'll see in the next chapter. Chapter 4. The Boss, the bestie, the high priestess of pretend. Conversing with young girls, ages 3 to 11. 4-year-old Mira runs into the preschool play yard, but instead of trotting toward her gaggle of friends, she stops short and heads over to her teacher. Eyes wide, left arm akimbo, right hand on her cheek with fingers splayed out, she sings, "Susanna, is that a new skirt I see?" "Good morning, Mira. Yes, I am wearing a new skirt today." "Where'd you get it?" "I bought it at a store called Anthropology." "I love that store. That's where they have glittering doorknobs in baskets." This interchange highlights some remarkable elements at play. Without planning or effort, Mira used a gangbuster opening line. Her question was triggered by instant recognition of visual cues, the specific design, color, or fabric of a skirt, that were weighed against a large body of information, her teacher's entire work wardrobe, stored in Mira's memory. Her use of advanced vocabulary words, glittering, doorknobs, baskets, and complex sentence structure enlivened the exchange, and her expressive pose signaled her curiosity, surprise, and delight. Mira's mastery of the art of conversation successfully charmed an adult listener, so successfully that now, many years later, I am able to relate word for word this dialogue between my daughter Susanna and her tiny student. Little girls are able to engage adults by speaking their language. Their eloquence and ability to interpret subtle verbal and nonverbal cues allow them to flourish in a wide variety of social settings. Most girls can easily tolerate the regimen of the classroom in early grades, partly because of their ability to listen and respond, and partly because they care deeply about pleasing the teacher. But the attributes that make for success in areas valued by our society also lead parents to have unrealistic expectations for their daughters. A common pitfall for parents of girls is mistaking their daughter's verbal sophistication for emotional maturity and interpreting her meltdowns as regression or manipulation. They're indignant because she sounds so worldly yet acts so childish. Adding to the confusion is the fact that girls are entering puberty earlier than they used to. 7 or 8 is now considered normal by the American Academy of Pediatrics. Parents of young children are dismayed when I tell them that the age of the onset of puberty continues to drop. What the American Academy of Pediatrics once classified as an abnormality called precocious puberty, defined by onset at age 8 in girls and 9 in boys, is now considered within the normal range. Although menstruation is a few years off, hormones make these girls susceptible to media messages about how females should look and act. Flirty, pretty, provocative. The girls' sassy words and alluring manner reflect those messages long before they understand what they mean. This is alarming to parents and supports their impression that the girls are 4 going on 40, but they're not. The spirited little fashionista isn't acting childish with her poutiness and demands. She is a child, and she's caught in a trap neither she nor her parents can see. Propelled by hormones, cultural pressures, and her proficiency with language, she comes across as experienced when in reality, she's more a canny observer and agile mimic. Her parents' frustration and dismay with her behavior can cause the girl to become doubly mad. Mad at them for being angry at her, and mad at herself because she wants to be their good girl. Yet, she can't help it. She keeps talking, arguing, and pleading her case because the words come so easily and her feelings are so intense. She has passionate preferences. Not that dress, not that yogurt, not that shampoo, story, pair of socks, not that crayon, purple, but not that purple. She has feverish desires. I told you everyone has a trampoline. An American Girl doll gets to stay up later than I do, has wedge shoes. And you said maybe, right? So when, Mom? You said. If you're the parent of a girl, you'll eventually come to realize that the arguments about everyday injustice or clothes or her room or hair or friends or food are not going to be resolved during a single, earnest, logical discussion. You'll want to pace yourself because raising a forthright, reasonable daughter means going over what feels like exactly the same gritty ground in slightly altered forms every day for years. With ages and stages in mind and with practice, you can adjust your message and delivery so that you and your daughter are able to ride the rapids of her childhood with less friction and more mutual appreciation. You can teach yourself to view her pickiness as discernment, her hyperbole as an abundance of heart. Working below your daughter's radar, you can guide her in a way that protects her wild individuality and rapid cognitive and physical growth, and at the same time teaches her good manners and family citizenship. A mother's burden. The relationship between daughters and mothers is significantly different from that between daughters and their dads. Before we tackle the best way to converse with a young girl, let's examine how these differences play out within a family. The anatomical brains of mothers and daughters share gender-specific design features. They are attuned to facial expressions, tone of voice, and body language, and they're programmed to sense and respond to the feelings and opinions of others. For an overview of brain development in females, see the PDF that comes with this program. These perceptions and the concern they stimulate is increased in female-to-female connections. When both mother and daughter are scrutinizing each other's tone, furrowed brow, or sigh, it can lead to emotional static. They may misread each other's motivations because, despite their similarities, a young girl and an adult woman have different perspectives. Or they can stumble together into over-talking problems, what psychologists call co-rumination. These dynamics lie at the root of many of the blow-ups between mothers and daughters. Added to the innate challenge of female-to-female communication are the specific pressures of our modern culture. Mothers today are extremely close to their children. Even when they work outside the home, moms are more often the ones involved on a microscopic level, organizing, scheduling, making sure the children arrive on time. This means that much of their communication with their children consists of questioning and prodding them. Mothers also are under a relatively new pressure to get parenting right. Consider that the use of the word parenting has become pervasive only over the past 20 years. Prior to that, the common term was child-rearing. It went from, your child is lovely, to, you're such a good mom, with the spotlight now on mom, not the child. Mothers worry about every choice, and there are so many choices to make. They feel as if they're being judged from every corner, the ghosts of their own family history, their parents and in-laws, the other moms, the school, the web, the media, social media. With so many voices weighing in, getting it right feels impossible. What about Dad? Today's fathers